It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Boko Haram claims responsibility for abducting nearly 300 Nigerian schoolgirls. China opens its wallet to African nations. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. The Islamist militant sect Boko Haram has claimed responsibility for last month's kidnapping of hundreds of schoolgirls in northern Nigeria. The group is threatening to sell them. The claim came in a Hausa language video released to news agencies Monday. In it, Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau said, "I abducted your girls and vows to sell them in the marketplace." He says, "A lady of 12, I'll give her out for marriage. A lady of 9, I'll give her hand for marriage, as they gave my mother out for marriage." Gunmen abducted the girls from a school in the town of Shabak, Borno State, April 14. Authorities say some escaped, but nearly 300 are still missing. Sunday, Nigeria's President Jonathan ordered top security officials to do everything possible to secure their release. Suspected Islamist gunmen crossed the border from Nigeria into Cameroon Monday, killing two people and freeing suspected Boko Haram fighters from an army post. Parts of the border town of Kuseri were ransacked. Moki Edwin Kinzuka reports.
State radio journalist Ebenezer Kanga, who is based in the area, told VOA in a telephone interview that the invaders opened fire indiscriminately.
As soon as they got to the brigade, they opened fire. One of the gendarmes on guard reposted in an attempt to push back the assailants.
Akanga said the attackers left with a huge consignment of arms and ammunition. He says defense forces have tightened security along the borders. It was the third time Boko Haram attacked the Cameroonian city, and each time they have killed Cameroonian soldiers. They are believed to have kidnapped 11 foreign workers, including 4 clergy. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The Associated Press reports Cameroonian soldiers freed 16 hostages abducted by unknown gunmen believed to be from Central African Republic. AP also reports at least 22 civilians killed in fighting last week in the north-central CAR town of Mala. Speaking in Nigeria Monday, Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta vowed attackers won't derail us. The comment followed Sunday's twin bus bombings in Nairobi that killed at least 3 and wounded dozens of others. It was the latest in a series of such bombings and attacks that have left at least 7 dead in Kenya in recent weeks. Chinese Premier Li Keqiang unveiled another aid package for Ethiopia Monday, totaling at least $12 billion. China also has announced agreements to increase credit lines to Africa by $10 billion and boost the China-Africa Development Fund by $2 billion. Ali Khan Sachu is an economist and trader based in Nairobi.
The Chinese basically have very deep pockets and are able to put their money to work. So for a leader of a country, China can be a game changer, because you could have, you know, projects which are, you know, were fantasy projects 10 years ago, but the Chinese can come in and say, okay, we think it's a good idea, let's do it. And I think that's what the African leaders appreciate. Plus, you know, China has an attitude towards governments that maybe Western governments don't have.
The Chinese premier in Africa is part of an 8-day four-nation trip that will also take him to Nigeria, Angola, and Kenya. The murder trial of South African runner Oscar Pistorius resumed after a break of several weeks, with the defendant's neighbor taking the stand. Carisi Stander testified Monday that she was at the runner's Pretoria home moments after the shooting of the athlete's 29-year-old girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp.
From the second that we walked into that house, like, he was frantic. When he saw us, he just kept on, Carisi, please, can we just put her in the car and get her to the hospital? And he just wanted to get her to the hospital, and I told him to, no, can you please, when he got it to the bottom of the stairs, I'm like, just put it down, so we can just see what's wrong.
Her husband, Johan Stander, told the court he received a distressed phone call from Pistorius in the middle of the night saying he killed his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp, thinking she was an intruder. South Africa's platinum miners might have rejected calls to end a 3-month strike, saying they had not reached agreement on the latest wage offer. The Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union is under growing pressure to end the walkout because of its impact on the South African economy. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. Many of the stories you've heard can also be found and read online at our website, the address voanews.com.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Boko Haram leaders promise to sell abducted girls as Nigeria's ruling party condemns the kidnapping.
In the case of the Boko Haram, they have not preached to the people what is their direction, and worse of it, they are engaging in suicide bombing, killing people indiscriminately, now even adopting people that are innocent.
Abdullahi Jallo is the spokesman for Nigeria's ruling People's Democratic Party. Thousands of Nigerian youth in Borno State join in the hunt for kidnapped girls. South Africa's president says the ruling ANC will overwhelmingly win tomorrow's election. And South Sudan's warring parties declare a one-month ceasefire.
The humanitarian situation in South Sudan is very dire. So now we worked out an agreement. The two parties, in the presence of mediators and the partners of IGAD, to open up humanitarian corridors.
Hussein Ma Unyot is the spokesman for rebels loyal to former South Sudan Vice President Riek Machar. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry pushes South Sudan parties towards negotiation. And the U.S. and Djibouti sign a 10-year lease on a U.S. military bases in the Horn of Africa. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The spokesman for Nigeria's ruling People's Democratic Party, the PDP, has condemned threats by the Islamic militant group Boko Haram to sell over 200 schoolgirls that the militants abducted last month. Abdullahi Jallo says President Goodluck Jonathan's government is doing everything possible to find the abducted girls. Despite criticism, it is not doing enough. Jallo tells reporter Peter Clotty that the ruling party has put pressure on the Jonathan administration to continue with its efforts to find the abducted girls.
In the case of the Boko Haram, they have not preached to the people what is their direction. They have not clearly said where they get the inscription of what they are doing. And worse of it, they are engaging in suicide bombing, killing people indiscriminately, now even adopting people that are innocent. This act has no provision in Islam and has no provision in any civilized world. It is just wickedness and barbaric and satanic.
Do you think the government has done enough to go looking for these abducted girls and to bring them home to their families?
The issue, Peter, is very clear. There is nowhere in the whole world where a leader like the president of Nigeria or any president of the world, that some part of the country where you are ruling, are dissatisfied with what you are doing and they are not happy with your leadership and you feel you will continue. That is not even contemplated. The government has put in place that wherever this girl is, even yesterday when the president had a media chat, he said wherever they are, they should be brought back. And he reaffirmed to people that no matter what, the government will spend its last blood, last effort to see that these girls have been returned to their loved ones.
People are saying that it's been days since these girls were abducted, and both the state and the federal government appeared not to have done anything at all until pressure was brought to bear. They are accusing the ruling party of not being competent to run the affairs of the country, including providing security for all Nigerians as mandated and enshrined in Nigeria's constitution. What do you say to that?
Look, the point in issue is that the ruling party is a party that is provided as a platform for all the politicians in Nigeria. That is the PDP. The President Jonathan has his own tenure to go, but the party remains. Now, if we, the officials of the party, which I believe the president is the leader of the party, will fold our hands to say we are not pursuing this issue. Now, if these girls happen to be killed, the party leadership will be charged for genocide. So we are protecting our interests, making all efforts, drawing the attention of the government, pushing through whatever means within the executive, the legislatures, the military and paramilitary and all whatnot to see the returns of these girls.
Abdoulaye Diallo is the spokesman for Nigeria's ruling People's Democratic Party. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the commercial capital, Lagos. Thousands of Nigerian youth in Borno State make up the Civilian Joint Task Force, known commonly as the Civilian JTF. They are scouring the region for the more than 200 schoolgirls who are still missing after being kidnapped from their school on April 14. Peregrino Brahima is a spokesman for Nigeria's Muslims Against Terror group. He tells Ricky Shryak the JTF mostly relays information from local residents about Boko Haram sightings to the security forces.
According to Senator Ndume from Borno Times, there's some information on where the girls are. The military is too slow to respond. Within the 3 weeks, there have been lots of reports of sightings of the girls by locals and civilian JTF of the girls. The military is too slow. At a point, the military said, the chief of military defense, Alex Bade, said, you know, that they can't go there. If they go there to try to get the girls, they would kill the girls. So they basically leave the terrorists to be able to run and move around. So from what we are hearing, a lot of them have been moved out of the country. Most of them are married, or a good number of them are married. So the situation is getting worse every day. This is not reversible anymore. It's irreversibly out of order.
What kind of efforts on the ground are there with the groups such as your group working with the parents of the girls to themselves find the girls?
What we work with are the civilian JTF, who are the largest number on the ground. And now, civilian JTF, what it is a group which is between 3,000 to 30,000 youth in the area. So it's an informal group. Most of them are informal. There's a registered aspect with the government, which are just about 1,000. So that's limited. And the registered aspects are only in the capital, Maiduguri. But we are talking about basically all youth of the states who are participating and helping. So they keep giving us information on movements. The problem in Nigeria is, for one thing, with the military, you don't have a rapid response. So, for instance, when Boko Haram comes to a community, before the military is going to respond, or if there's a call for the military, it takes a long time. Some communities could be attacked for 8 hours without a response. There are so many things lacking in security infrastructure in those communities. The civilian JTF are planning right now to actually take a procession to the government to ask again for being the right to be able to have better arms to confront the terrorists.
These are civilian groups.
These are all civilian. The main thing they are working with right now is just information from villagers on sightings, from the Fulani and other villagers who tell them, okay, we heard they were here, or we heard they are here. And all that information is coordinated to the government.
Peregrino Brahima is the spokesman for the Nigerian group Muslims Against Terror. He was speaking to Ricky Shryak from New York. The government of South Sudan and rebels allied to former Vice President Riek Machar have signed an agreement declaring a one-month ceasefire. Hussein Ma Unyad, a spokesman for the rebels SPLM in opposition, says the accord will make it possible for humanitarian aid to reach hundreds of thousands of people in many areas who are trapped by the fighting.
The humanitarian situation in South Sudan is very dire. So now we worked out an agreement, the two parties, in the presence of mediators and the partners of IGAD, to open up humanitarian corridors. One important thing that we have also agreed is actually this month of May, say from the 7th of May to the 7th of June, that we want to make it a month of tranquility, that this will enable our people actually to get some relief food. People will go back to their villages to plant because this is a rainy season, and also that people can go and care for their livestock.
People out here are saying that both of you are known for not respecting what you sign in Addis Ababa. What makes it different this time that both of you will respect this agreement that you have signed?
It is true that the first agreement that we signed was the cessation of hostilities, and cessation of hostilities was not respected. One important article was actually the withdrawal of foreign forces, like the Uganda forces and the other rebels of North Sudan that are actually present fighting along with the government of South Sudan. That agreement was not respected because these two articles were not actually implemented. Now, this agreement is actually about humanitarian matters. We are very concerned that our people are really suffering. The situation is horrible, that our people need some relief. Our people need some services.
Correct me if I'm wrong. This agreement means that from today and tomorrow, you will still continue fighting each other until the 7th, and then you will stop fighting. Is that right?
That is not the case, because any agreement must have a date that actually when it is going to come to effect. But already there is fighting, because the time the whole international community, the people in the region here, the churches, everybody is appealing for peace, that we need to stop war. The government was busy preparing, and you heard yesterday that they attacked Nasir, they attacked Bentiu, and they entered the towns. And this is completely in violation with the appeals that people are making, that we should stop the war.
And let's talk about the mechanism of implementing this humanitarian access. Where is your humanitarian organization based? Because it looks like you are scattered all over these places.
We are grateful to the government of Kenya and Ethiopia that we managed to open liaison offices here, so that if there are relief agencies that are moving from Ethiopia, we have an office here that can liaise with them.
Hussein Ma Onyot is the spokesman for the rebel group SPLM in opposition. He was speaking from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, with John Tanza of VOA South Sudan in Focus program. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is condemning South Sudan for violating a ceasefire agreement with rebels as he is pushing the leaders of that rebellion to join peace talks in Ethiopia. VOA State Department correspondent Cass Stearns reports from Angola, where Secretary Kerry met Monday with President José Eduardo dos Santos to discuss conflicts in the Central African Republic and the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Secretary Kerry says an offensive by ground troops in South Sudan against rebel positions in the north violates the terms of a ceasefire meant to end 4 months of violence in the world's newest nation. The most serious fighting began in late December, soon after President Salva Kiir's government accused former Vice President Riek Machar of trying to seize power. President Kiir told Secretary Kerry that he'll join peace talks in the Ethiopian capital, but Machar is resisting, telling reporters that he does not believe the conflict can be ended by establishing a transitional government before new elections. Kerry says Machar has concerns about the logistics of peace talks, but left the door open.
He expressed some doubts, but he didn't say he wouldn't go. And I talked to Prime Minister Haile Mariam, who made it clear to me that Mr. Machar made a commitment to him that he would come.
Kerry says Machar has a fundamental decision to make about his future in South Sudan and his previous commitment to join peace talks.
If he decides not to and procrastinates, then we have a number of different options that are available to us. We said we are serious. There will be accountability and implications if people do not join into this legitimate effort.
Kerry says those implications include sanctions, the imposition of an African intervention force, and international judicial action against those responsible for atrocities. He spoke to reporters in the Angolan capital Monday following talks with President José Eduardo dos Santos, during which he says he thanked the Angolan leader for backing peace efforts in the Central African Republic and in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Angola is playing a central role, integral role, really, in bringing African nations together and in leading them towards an enduring peace, we hope, in the Great Lakes region.
He says the United States and Angola will work more closely on issues of energy, health, and technology, as well as increasing the number of Angolans in senior positions within the country's petroleum industry. This is the last stop on a trip that's included talks with heads of state in Ethiopia, South Sudan, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Scott Stearns, VOA News, Luanda.
The United States and Djibouti have signed a new 10-year agreement on a U.S. military base in Djibouti that the White House calls a critical part of the fight against terrorism. President Barack Obama announced the deal on Monday at a White House meeting with Djiboutian President Ismail Omar Guelleh. But while Djibouti is strategic to the United States, there are many who worry about any pivot of U.S. foreign policy towards what they call the militarization of Africa. VOA's Caroline Presutti explains.
Djibouti is a geographical goldmine. With its busy port, it sits strategically in the Horn of Africa. It's across the Gulf of Aden from Yemen and bordered by Ethiopia, Eritrea, and Somalia, making it a prime counterterrorism partner for the United States. Djibouti is home to 3,000 U.S. civilian and military personnel at Camp Limonye, the only permanent U.S. military base in Africa, located next to the Djibouti International Airport. The U.S. pays $38 million a year to lease the base.
Its location, the Red Sea.
Joe Siegel is research director at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies.
The U.S. has calculated that putting the money into what's seen as a relatively stable country in a very strategic location with access to a lot of unstable countries will pay off both in near and the long term.
Camp Lamonye serves as an anti-terrorism hub for the Horn of Africa and the Arabian Peninsula. Up until recently, it was used to launch U.S. drone strikes against suspected al-Qaeda fighters.
And when I respond, then you tell me, that's correct.
Ben Fred Mensah teaches international relations and government at Howard University.
Terrorism is very much alive, you know. And as America always says, it's better we fight them outside than to wait, you know, and fight them at home.
But Djibouti residents complained when 5 drones in 3 years crashed, one just 1.5 kilometers from Djibouti City. So the U.S. moved the drone fleet to another airstrip, 13 kilometers away from the airport. So for the U.S. government, it's a question of balance. Djibouti's human rights record is not stellar. Freedom House, a human rights reporting agency, labeled Djibouti as not free in last year's Freedom in the World report. It accused President Omar Guelleh of suppressing civil liberties and ranked its political rights near the bottom. Abayomi Azakiwe, the editor of Pan-African News Wire, is totally against the U.S. military buildup. In a Skype interview, he says there's more at play than terrorism.
Due to the fact that more and more oil is being imported from Africa into the United States, as well as other strategic minerals, that, in our opinion, is guiding this increased military presence.
Fred Mensah's opposition stems from his African roots.
I'll begin to question as to whether we still enjoy our sovereignty, you know, or whether we are losing our sovereignty because we are relatively weak.
The Pentagon plans to spend more than $1 billion over the next 25 years to expand and renovate Camp Lamonye, reaffirming its presence in Africa. Carolyn Presutti, VOA News, Washington.
South African President Jacob Zuma says he is confident his African National Congress party will win tomorrow Wednesday's elections overwhelmingly, despite a mounting cloud of corruption allegations. The ANC has won every national poll for 20 years, but has received increasing criticism in recent years. VOA's Anita Powell covered Mr. Zuma's news conference in Johannesburg and filed this report.
President Jacob Zuma has been busy in the final days ahead of elections Wednesday, the fifth national vote since South Africa became an inclusive democracy in 1994. The ANC has dominated polls since that first free vote, and Mr. Zuma told reporters Monday that he's sure they'll do it again on May 7th.
We think the ANC will win the elections, overwhelmingly, not just by, you know, the skin of a teeth.
Local pollsters have predicted the ANC will win with 63% of the vote. In a lengthy and wide-ranging two-hour briefing, Mr. Zuma struck a far different tone than he did Sunday during the party's massive Siyankoba, or victory, rally. There, at a packed Soweto stadium, he sang, danced, and appealed to the ANC's large base, which, like South Africa itself, is diverse, but is mostly black and poor. For Monday morning's press briefing, he jettisoned his flashy green and gold ANC outfit for a professorial oxblood red blazer. He also attempted to address a report by the nation's public protector that found he misused some $23 million of public funds to make renovations to his private homestead, Nkandla. Mr. Zuma devoted 20 minutes to explaining his case, but also said he wasn't worried about the corruption allegations' effect at the polls.
I'm not worried about Nkandla. It's not my problem. Nor is a problem of the people that have been campaigning. In all the province I've gone, not a single person has asked a question, either in the rallies or in the houses that I've gone to. The people are not worried about it.
Mr. Zuma's camp has said the improvements were for presidential security. Those improvements to his home in rural KwaZulu-Natal province included a swimming pool, a cattle enclosure, a chicken run, a visitor center, and an amphitheater. But in a surprising disclosure, Mr. Zuma explained why he needed security at the estate.
My homestead was burned twice during violence. And secondly, my wife, criminals came, raped my wife during the time I was still the MEC. So the issue of security at Nkandla has not been a theoretical issue.
He declined to provide details, such as when exactly the attack happened, other than that detail that it was when he was a member of the ANC's executive council, prior to his presidency. Critics of the ANC tend to point out corruption scandals and the millions of South Africans who still lack access to electricity and clean water, 2 decades after the end of white minority rule. Despite this, the party appears on track to win big in Wednesday's election. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Twenty-five minutes past the hour. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports news, we begin with kickboxing. Ugandan Umar Semata edged Egyptian defending champion Abdallah Hussein Mando by 146 to 139 points to win the World Kickboxing Federation welterweight title in Kampala, Uganda on Monday. Turning to athletics, Botswana's three-time Africa high jump champion Kabelo Hosimang aims to retain his title at the Africa Senior Athletics Championships in Marrakech, Morocco in August. He recently won his event in a championship record of 2.21 meters at the University Sports South Africa Athletics Championships in the capital, Tshwane. Kabelo explains why he has relocated from Germany to South Africa.
I want to finish my studies in University of Johannesburg, which I'm studying right now, transport management. Yeah, so and when I'm looking at the weather, it's perfect to start to train here in South Africa, and the facilities are very good in South Africa here.
You're the Africa champion, three-time Africa champion in high jump. It's never happened before. Going to Morocco for the Africa championships, you must be feeling a bit of pressure that others will now want to take the win off you, especially given that we are making the Africa team for the IAAF Continental Cup.
Yeah, it will be quite interesting to go to Morocco, because looking at for the moment, there's a guy from Sudan, Mohammed, who already jumped 228 in the indoor, and he went to the world indoor. So for me, it's kind of a challenge in Africa that I have never had before. So I'm looking forward for that challenge, and I'll be well prepared to defend my title in Africa as an African champion.
Well, your personal best is 234. The way training is going, is there any chance that you may want to improve on that this year?
My idea for this year, honestly, is to improve my 234, because looking at that, there's Commonwealth Games also.
Yes.
So the Commonwealth Games, you know there's Canada guy, yes, already, and there's British guys. So I'm looking forward to improve my 234. So far it's working, because my first competition I jumped 228.
That was Kabelo Hosimang, the three-time Africa high jump champion, speaking in Tshwane, South Africa. Finally, Benin required extra time to pip Mali 2-1 to win the West Africa Football Union WAFU A Under-17 Championships in Lome, Togo. Nigeria thrashed Togo 3-0 in the bronze medal playoff. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Our listener mail for this Tuesday morning comes from Mohammed Ahmed Masuo of Monrovia, Liberia. He says, dear VOA, as South Africans go to the polls tomorrow, I would like to urge them to wisely choose a candidate who will represent the interests of all South Africans. I hope the election will be free of all irregularities. I wish the people of South Africa a peaceful, free, fair, and transparent election. Thank you, Mohammed Ahmed Masuo of Monrovia, Liberia, for your comment. And please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. And that's it for this Tuesday, May 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post editor Mark Ullman, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Button, Washington, wishing everybody in Africa a very good Tuesday.
What's going on? What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you on board. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks. Get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. Cheers, cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah. Now there is a youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.